For the next hour, we are going to be talking about the way in which nonviolent communication and resonant language and neuroscience can all be a support to us in seeing the unseen in our relationships in order to prepare us. In that class, we'll be doing a deep dive into the effect that trauma has on relational connection and our capacity to forgive, and how it is that we exactly kind of do the grand slalom of relational connection around all of the events that happen that can feel like small and large betrayals and sort of the dropping of life energy that happens on a regular basis in our human connections. And is part of the reason that I always ask that question, are we willing to be loved by humans? Am I, Sarah, willing to be loved by humans? Always a good question. Always a question that I have to stop and think about before I can answer. It's not an automatic of course for me. It's more like, I just need a little acknowledgement that being loved by humans is tricky. So that's what our focus is today, is the shadow in human relationship, what nonviolent communication can offer, how we can think about this with both neuroscience and resonant language, everything that we've been learning about the right hemisphere and its importance. Here's one of the beautiful quotes from C.G. Jung, Carl Jung, who was the creator or the first person to write about this idea of the shadow in quite the intensity and focus and care and thoughtfulness that he brought to this question of what it is that we don't know about ourselves. And he wrote, "No tree, it is said, can grow to heaven unless its roots reach down to hell." So as we move into our relational connections, we need to be able to see ourselves somewhat with clarity, as much clarity as we can muster. And we also need to be bringing kind of a yes to our humanness into the equation of whether or not we are coming with our full selves into our relationships. So tonight, what we're going to be looking at is the question, what is the shadow in relationship? What do we know about that we don't know? We'll be looking at this from the point of view of our two brain hemispheres, from the ideas of explicit and implicit, which roughly correlate with conscious and unconscious, our deep brain structures, and any disowned circuits that may be a part of our world. And then the question also that we'll touch upon briefly, whether we really embrace ourselves as part of the collective shadow, hugely important for us during this time of a kind of collective denial of the impact of the loss of species all over our planet and global climate crisis. And then we'll pay a little attention to empathy and vow work as we go along. So as we begin here, I just would like to speak about the painful present day and historical associations between even the word shadow, the color black, and the use of the word black to speak about people of African origin. This is something that we want to be in a clear and as explicit as possible relationship with, since there's something of the shadow in even using the word black to speak about people of African origin and not acknowledging all of the ways that we use the word black that tend to be negative or unconscious or unknown. So as much as possible, except when I'm directly quoting Jung, I will use the words unconscious, implicit, or unknown rather than the words dark or black to refer to the shadow. And additionally, in Jungian quotes, he was a product of his time about gender and saw only the binary of man and woman, of he and she. So we may play with changing those quotes if they show up intensely here. The idea of the shadow was a general concept developed by Carl Jung to hold the idea that everyone has parts of ourselves that we know nothing about and that we even disown, including ideas and conceptions, weaknesses and shortcomings, desires, instincts, sometimes addictions, sometimes compulsions. In an IPNB sense, we could say most of what we do and think and feel is not under our conscious control. The vast jungles of neurons operate their own programs. The eye that flickers to life when you wake up in the morning is the smallest bit of what's transpiring in your brain. Carl Jung, he was a Swiss psychiatrist. He was the founder of analytical psychology. He's best known for his theories of the collective unconscious, including the shadow, and also the concept of archetypes and the use of synchronicity in psychotherapy. Along with Sigmund Freud, Jung was a pioneer of modern theories of the relationships between the conscious and unconscious aspects of mind. But while Freud postulated a psychosexual explanation for human behavior, Jung perceived our primary motivating force to be spiritual in origin. This brings us back a little bit to Marshall Rosenberg and his idea that the need for contribution was the primary motivating force among humans. According to Jung, it was from the soul that the complementary drives of differentiation and integration arise, fueling the processes of growth, development, and healing. And just catching for any of those of you who have experienced spiritual abuse or spiritual hypocrisy to move away from the word soul if we need to. But according to Jung, it would be from the central, essential part of our being that these drives for individuation and integration arise. And that this is where the movement toward healing comes from in our relational connections. So in Jungian psychology, the shadow or shadow aspect is a part of our unconscious that includes weaknesses, shortcomings, and instincts that we don't know about. Everyone carries a shadow, Jung wrote. And the less it is embodied in the individual's conscious life, the more dense it is. It may be in part one's link to more primitive animal instincts, which are superseded during early childhood by the conscious mind. The shadow was one of Jung's four main archetypes. He had the persona, the self, the shadow, and what he thought of as the male and female parts of the being. And so here's a little graphic that I enjoyed. Here's what we do know, what we know we don't know, what we think we know, and what we don't know that we don't know. None of us, says Carl Jung, stands outside humanity's black collective shadow. Again, using the word black. Having a shadow is integral to being human. If we know this, we can mitigate our tendency to harm. Here are the general brain areas and systems which do the most harm when we know nothing about them. So your being here on this call this evening or this day is an action that is a standing up for fully claiming the self as much as possible and being responsible for our shadow, because we can't know everything about it and we don't know when it's going to pop out and we don't know kind of harm it's going to do, but we can make some guesses. And the better we are at guessing, the more we can track our impact on others and make relational repairs to them when things have happened that are painful, difficult, alarming, unconsciously dismissing, all kinds of things. So with the hemispheres, we can have left shifts into non-relational space. We can have unconscious bias that we don't even know about. We can do right hemisphere in-group, out-group, exclusion, scapegoating, and we can also have unconscious contracts and unhealed traumas which bind our circuits of motivation and emotion together, making the doing of harm compulsive. So if, for example, when we are angry, our sexuality comes out, if it always comes out in our anger, especially at significant others, then all of a sudden we're in a shadow territory where rage and sexuality become mixed. This is what we mean by binding circuits of emotion and motivation together. When there's an always or a tendency for things to happen together, then it can be that we do harm compulsively, rather than being able to have choice and fluidity and being able to bring, for example, if we wanted to bring play and care into our sexuality rather than rage, then that would be a nice choice to be able to make, and it would do much less harm to the people that we love. The thing about the human brain is that it's a monster for pattern making, that it's the job of the human brain to make patterns to try to save energy. It conserves energy and lets us consider things abstractly if we make patterns. So the hemispheres are what we use to make patterns with. And if we think about the shadow and the patterns that are made with the shadow, there's the left hemisphere element of shadowing and the left hemisphere element of painful experiences and unconscious experiences in relational connection. For those of us who study relational neuroscience, the shadow is what we don't know that we know about ourselves, particularly the things we don't know that we are doing that can be harmful to self, others, to non-human animals, and to the world. Our most harmful capacity is the unconscious left shift, Well, most harmful is sort of a left hemisphere thing to say. So one of the harmful capacities is our unconscious left shift, the movement into the left hemisphere into non-relational space. This movement obliterates the needs of anyone or anything else except the self, and it doesn't even hold on to the needs of our own deep self, because once we start to enter the deep self, the needs are for connection, for sweetness, for acknowledgement of everyone, for everyone to exist. They're very deep and beautiful needs, just as Marshall had mentioned, that need for contribution being one of our deepest needs. Others actually exist for us in that deep space. But in the more shallow spaces in our brain, especially in the left hemisphere, other people do not even exist for us. And so a left shift enables cruelty, injustice, rigidity, dismissal, criticism, and contempt. And it also plays a major role in unconscious bias. The left hemisphere is a master at reductive pattern making. It is very sensitive to status, hierarchy, measuring, comparison, and fairness. Who has more? The left hemisphere wants to ask. Who is better? Who is more beautiful? Who is smarter? Who is younger? Who is stronger? All of these are the questions that the comparing mind asks, and the comparing mind is the left hemisphere. The left hemisphere likes to express, and it will expand to take up whatever space is offered it. So here's an interesting thing for me here on this call with you today. Here I am, taking up a ton of space. I don't even have anybody else on the call with me. So that's quite an extraordinary space, because it's not a relational space. I kept thinking, how will I make this a relational space if I'm the only one here? We'll see how I do. We may be able to get into a little bit, but mostly I'll be in this expressive space where I don't know what's happening for you, because you're happening at a different time. I'm time traveling to you with no relationality whatsoever. And the left hemisphere is the home of unconscious bias, because it's trying to use patterns to save energy. So it's thinking, oh, all labor union leaders are difficult, or all organic vegetables are expensive, and people who buy organic vegetables are hippies, or all white men in suits are untrustworthy. These are the kinds of unconscious bias that we may make. And then the ones, of course, that are about people of color are even more harmful and even more difficult, and as we will see, impact people's health. The language of the left hemisphere in its reductiveness and generalizations is the home of the harm done when we leave the realm of the personal. So this photograph shows a couple lost in their devices, sort of talking to each other, but not really, just kind of running through the motions while they're in relationship with their devices, which is one way to do a left shift. And another way is microaggressions. So microaggressions are ways that we use language that diminish the reality of another person's existence. This is not something we know very much about. Marshall didn't teach about microaggressions. And they are an absolute part of the language of jackals. And they're subtle and kind of scary, because they impact people's health. So, for example, if you meet somebody who is a person of color who comes from England, and you say, oh my God, you don't look English, where's your family really from? Then you're diminishing what they've told you. You're making a statement based on their visual affect, what they look like, and you're not really listening to them. And people do this all the time. You have a white person who looks like they have immigrated from Africa, and you're like, where did you come from? This is a microaggression, because we're not really staying in present time. We're making an imagination pattern about somebody else, and then we're revealing that we're not really seeing the other person. So here's this, wow, you're really articulate, being said to a person of color. There's a surprise. Oh my goodness, how could a person of color be articulate? That impacts people's health and immune systems. You're a much better driver than I expected, to a woman, any woman, banking into the idea that women are not good drivers. It impacts people's health and well-being, not to be actually seen for who they are, but to be compared or referenced to a larger group. The greater the numbers of microaggressions that a person receives, the more their health is impacted. So here are a number of words that we use that we can even use in a so-called friendly way that are words that are even more explicit microaggressions. And I look at these and I have so much mourning and worry and love and care for all of us trying to make our way through a world with brains that make patterns and wipe other people out and cause them harm. So now that we've spoken a little bit about the left hemisphere, only a little, we'll speak a little about the right hemisphere, and we'll talk about the right hemisphere element of the shadow. Another harm that our brain can do comes from the right hemisphere. The right hemisphere is where we experience belonging. And when we experience our belonging with in-group members over the needs of self, others, non-human animals, and the world, we're capable of great harm from the macro scale of genocide and global climate change down to the micro level of microaggressions and implicit bias. So in microaggressions, when I'm affiliating myself with white people to whom America belongs, then I might say to a person of color, "Where are you really from?" Or, "What language do you speak?" Or if I'm affiliating myself with people in white supremacy, then I would speak the way that Trump speaks, and I would denigrate people who come from other ethnic backgrounds and other religions and other language groups and have had their parents come from another country and then have a visible non-white visage, and that would be harming. It's, you know, in this moment, I'm just experiencing my body stopping speaking, even in shock at what's being modeled for us in this moment at the highest levels. 2019, I'm making this show here in August of 2019, and the grief cuts through me like a knife about the way in which language is being used at our highest levels to do this kind of harm, to do the harm of exclusion, rather than creating an inclusive and self-responsible world. So here's another quote from Carl Jung. "The shadow is a moral problem that challenges the whole ego personality, for no one can become conscious of the shadow without more considerable moral effort. To become conscious of it involves recognizing the dark aspects of the personality as present and real." To become conscious of it involves recognizing the unknown aspects of the personality as present and real. This act is the essential condition for any kind of self-knowledge, and it therefore, as a rule, meets with considerable resistance. Indeed, self-knowledge as a therapeutic measure frequently requires much painstaking work extending over a long period of time, because we will not even recognize, we will not even be able to catch and make repairs for the things that we do until we begin to deepen in and practice. It's not an immediate thing that we get to know all about our shadows and suddenly become fully self-responsible and live nonviolently. It's a much bigger effort than that. So now we're going to come back to the left hemisphere. So just to hit that right hemisphere piece again, the right hemisphere makes us want to belong, but it also wants to create out-groups, because if it can create an out-group and we're part of the in-group, then we get to have oxytocin. So it's very powerful neurobiologically for Mr. Trump to make everybody that's not white into an out-group so that the white people can feel like they really belong and that they really have an in-group. And that's a powerful neurobiological hit of dopamine and oxytocin. It's a neurochemical cocktail of satisfaction that is part of our shadow. The left hemisphere, the shift into non-relational space. For the left hemisphere, in order to be able to track our errors, the anterior cingulate has to kick in. So whatever falsehoods each of us believes are necessarily invisible to us. We can be wrong, or we can know that we're wrong, but we can't do both at the same time. So it's kind of like we need to have a bit of a review committee inside of our own brain that lets us learn and see. Now, this is a big macro of this is when we're trying to make repairs for difficult parenting. When we're trying to make repairs for difficult parenting, what we have to do is we have to begin to see what we did in our unconscious and shadow states as parents, ways in which we took actions that were power over, that were diminishing, that were dismissing, that were shaming, that were blaming. And we have to begin slowly, slowly to see whether our children even want to have conversations with us about the things that have happened. We don't have any category called errors I have made in our brain. We have to search under shame or guilt or conflict or fear often in order to find these difficult places. This quote says, "Mistakes have been made, others will be blamed." Our shame, our capacity for shame, which is hugely important for us to be able to track our experiences, make sense of them, make repairs with ourselves, notice when we have an experience of stepping into being an out-group, notice when we have an experience of having done something or caused harm in some way, that our review panel can then remember and take a look at. Shame is hugely important for us to help us live in integrity and try to figure out our relationship with our shadow. If we have no shame, it's not impossible, but certainly tricky to locate our own shadow. Shame comes online between 10 and 18 months along with a sense of self. Guilt comes later at about 3 years of age when we have a sense of being able to track our actions and their impact on others. So people don't really believe that they often make mistakes or are wrong. Another aspect of the shadow, as it is reflected in brain function, is an interesting self-destructive one, and that is when we believe the default mode network. The brain runs in circuits, sort of like the underground, London Underground, or any large metro mass transit system. And one of these transit systems in the brain is the automatic social circuit that comes online when we stop using our brain intentionally. It's called the default mode network, or DMN. Most of the spaces of the DMN, the default mode network, are located along the midline of the brain, which is where we carry our sense of self. And when our default mode network is working well, what it's doing is all kinds of really wonderful integrative things for us. It's helping our mind to wander. It's helping us to daydream. It's doing memory retrieval for us. It's imagining the future. It's simulating how we can best take action in order to have a good outcome. It's thinking about other people and how they're responding, which is called theory of mind reasoning. And it's our capacity for creative cognition. It also possibly is what runs our night dreaming as well. When we pay attention to something that's external, our default mode network stops working. And here's a way in which we have this implicit bias that we talked about earlier. In racial self-identity, people who are our race light up the default mode network that helps us project self onto them. Others light up the thinking part of the brain and appear to the brain as non-self. So just take a moment, whatever. There are folks of various skin color here in this photograph, and I invite you to choose one of the people in this photograph who has not your skin color and to allow yourself to move into a place of being self with them instead of non-self. You can do it with gender, you can do it with skin color, you can do it with what kinds of clothing is being worn. Just allow yourself to feel into being with, fully with, someone that you wouldn't normally allow yourself to perceive as self. So there's one way that the default mode network kind of tricks us. It does an automatic pattern making where it thinks that we are separate from people who have different skin colors than we have, or wear different clothing than we have, or have different hairstyles than we have. And what if we were truly all interdependent? What if we all really mattered to each other? On a personal level, rather than this sort of systemic level of identification, on the personal level, trauma fractures our default mode network, altering its connectivity. The trauma memories then will create vortices that will pull our thoughts towards the sense we made of the original traumas, which can be either horrific self-blame or mistrust of the world and hypervigilance. Both can be part of our shadow. We can have a shadow experience of believing ourselves to be horrible or toxic. We can have a shadow experience of believing the world to be horrible or toxic. And this is our movement into the implicit bias material. We make patterns without knowing it. For example, in North America, white people make quicker associations between European American and good as opposed to African American and good. And you can take these kinds of implicit bias tests through the Harvard implicit bias testing website. The more power I have, the more my brain tends to be unconsciously biased and dismissive of non-power groups. So take a look here and decide which picture you find more attractive. We often don't know what attracts us. Dilated eyes increase beauty and attractiveness, but we wouldn't be able to say why one face seemed more attractive than another. People used to know this more consciously. Women have used belladonna eye drops throughout history to increase their beauty, to make their pupils dilate, although the use of belladonna can actually lead to blindness. So then, coming back into the right hemisphere, what do we sacrifice for belonging? We'll sacrifice our rightness for belonging. We'll bring our sense of reality into alignment with that held by the group, and this will be more intense the more isolated we are from others who hold our similar opinions. The greater our sense of belonging, the less accurately we tend to be able to decode emotions and expressions from the outgroup. So when we imagine integration, integration is this beautiful quote from Carl Jung, where love rules, there is no will to power, and where power predominates, love is lacking. The one is the shadow of the other. So the more that we follow this path and do this work, the more room we make for ourselves to notice our unconscious pattern making, to notice our implicit bias, to notice our microaggressions, and to be able to make repairs to the people that we care about and people we don't care about in order to acknowledge harm and to make a better world. Carl Jung writes, "A man who is unconscious of himself acts in a blind, instinctive way. The functions of the lower brain are performed automatically without our conscious awareness, and this includes much of our addictive activity. In the cerebellum, for example, escalation of aggression is inevitable for us. Humans always overestimate the force that we have received and pay it back more intensely. So if somebody knocks into us and we're knocking back into them, then our knocking back into them is necessarily going to be with more force than they knocked into us. And then at the edge of our availability to conscious awareness, the limbic system exists. And this is where we have those circuits of emotion and motivation, which we were mentioning early on when I was talking about sexuality and how it can be linked with rage when we really would much prefer it to be linked with care and play, for example. Next, we're coming to Beatrice Beebe, and all of these things that we're touching so very briefly in this one-hour presentation are things that are we will touch upon more deeply in our series that starts in January. So if this stuff is going by too quickly, or if it's tantalizing you, or if you're longing for more time to dig in, please know that you can bring your questions and your interest to the group that's starting in January. Beatrice Beebe is another researcher whose work is of primary importance for us to understand the way in which we make early nervous system agreements to be a certain way and to only express a certain amount of emotion. She discovered that by the age of 4 months, an infant limits their facial expression vocabulary exactly to what their mother's easily able to reflect, which means that an infant, it's possible for an infant to absolutely stop displaying anger, grief, fear. It's almost like that the infant will effectively stop feeling the anger, grief and fear. It's like they'll get an error 404 message when they're looking for their own feelings. Or they will also limit their life energy and happiness so that it doesn't exceed what their mother is comfortable with. So if a person has shut their door on grief, if their mother was not able to reflect grief, then this person, if they've never really been accompanied with grief, if they've never done the work of opening the door of this shadow that has been cast upon their own feelings, then this person cannot integrate anything that is hard or painful. Like, it's impossible without grief to navigate the effects of childhood adversity, the harmful effects of privilege, the after effects of assault, the after effects of childhood abuse, global climate change, global climate crisis. All of these things are not negotiable. We're not able to pass through these passageways unless we have had some accompaniment for our grief or anger also. And if you have anger in response to any of the things that we were just mentioning, the emotional energy that would naturally go to anger, for example, would have to be funneled into the grief circuit or the fear circuit or the seeking circuit. And then people will carry these emotional limitations and entanglements forward into their adult lives. And this creates disowned shadows of emotion that can't be expressed and that tend to cause difficulty in our most private and personal and beloved connections with the people that we love. And then people will live a life apart from their unknown or disowned life energy, which is so not what we want for ourselves or for others. We want to fully claim our life energy and be able to live with sweetness and some sense of fullness and some capacity to track ourselves as people moving through space. Doing the best we can, bringing our shadows with us, our shadows sometimes bringing joy that we cannot express, sometimes bringing rage that we cannot express, sometimes causing harm that we don't know that we've caused. The shadow archetypes are deeply connected with attachment patterns. So when you see the 12 shadow archetypes, which include sorcerer, dictator, victim, shadow witch, addict, idiot, trickster, destroyer, slave, shadow mother, hag, and hermit, then you can also see the ways in which these are connected with attachment patterns. Our attachment patterns that make us controlling, punitive and controlling, take us into dictator, take us into destroyer, take us into hag, take us into some aspects of shadow witch and shadow mother. Our incapacity to self-regulate and our turning away from self towards substance or behavior takes us into addict or takes us into slave or takes us into trying to control everything and being a sorcerer or being unable to stay in integrity and moving into the trickster energy. All of these things are connected with the way that we've been held and treated. Our capacity to be in an integrous relationship with our own shadow is very much a question that is based on the question either how much integrity were our parents able to have, or also how much repair work have we been able to do as adults, or how much of a relationship with nature or divine do we have that allows us to move into that space of humility, which is the most important space of all, the space of humility. It allows us to see harm that we've done and to acknowledge and to make repairs for what we have carried out. Cruelty is the result of harsh, punitive, and rigid treatment of infants. It is a frightening thought, says Jung, that man also has a shadow side to him, consisting not just of little weaknesses and foibles, but of a positively demonic dynamism. And narcissism comes from this same area of attachment. Addiction is the entanglement of brain regulation with the seeking circuit, often in the search for warmth or care, as when we search for opioids. Sometimes the search for energy, for movement, which can take us for a kind of an intensity and an ecstasy. All of these things are part of the dopamine circuit if we're focused on methamphetamines, for example. slave and victim have been consumed, have each been consumed by the other, and unintegrated trauma hijacks the brain's default mode network so that the person sees themselves as a shadow being. If a baby is not seen with soft eyes, acknowledgement, and presence, the baby has a hard time growing up to see themselves with soft eyes. The baby instead will see themselves as being someone who should not be looked at if the mother can't look at the baby. Additionally, we've talked now about the personal elements of the shadow, the ways in which we can do harm without even knowing it by not knowing really about the effect of the pattern making of our human brain. But then let's just spend a moment at least in this time of planetary peril to acknowledge that an individual's shadow is invariably bound up with the collective shadow of his group. And this is good news for us as we digest our own evil. A fragment of the collective evil is invariably co-digested at the same time. This is an Eric Newman quote. So when we think about the left and right hemisphere, it kind of takes us back towards unconscious bias and the collective shadow. So as part of our collective societal shadow, who do we not see? Do we not see those who don't have power or money? Do we not see the homeless? Do we not see folks who have a different skin color than the power holders? Do we not see folks who are a gender that is different from the power holders? Do we not see the aged? Do we not see the children? Do we not see those who are differently able? Do we not see the neurodivergent? Do we not see the mentally or physically ill? Do we not see other species? These ways that we do not see are part of us being a part of the collective shadow. Chuck Palahniuk writes, Carl Jung called this his shadow work. He said, we never see others. Instead, we only see aspects of ourselves that fall over them. Shadows, projections, our associations. And for this, I believe that there are moments when the soul of the other, we catch an apprehension, we catch a hint that another person exists, and it can be quite a beautiful hint. It can be in something nonverbal, an exchange of eye contact with a stranger. It can be a touch with just the backs of the hands brushing with someone we love. It can be a sudden sense of gratitude and capacity for vision with a public figure. We get these hints of people actually existing, hints that take us toward wholeness, toward love. And then another capacity that it's always important to talk about when we're talking about shadow and shadow work is the left and the right hemispheres, seeing in others what we disown in ourselves. We will often think that others see the world the same way that we do. That's what we'll base our theory of mind on, even though not everybody sees the world in the same way. Humans are very gifted at self-deception. And different types of self-deception include denial of ongoing self-deception, self-inflation, ego-biased social theory, false narratives of intention, and a conscious mind that operates via denial and projection to create a self-serving world. We can also, interestingly, engage in self-deception when we reduce all of our motivation and intention to something ego-driven, and we fail to see our own generosity and depth of spirit. If our theory of mind about ourselves is not generous, which we may not even realize, then we'll often see others in the same negative light. The more we disown an understanding of ourselves, the more completely we will see the motives of others as being self-serving, negative, egotistical, or bereft of morals. And the more we see ourselves with generosity and acknowledge the blockages that are brought about by unconscious contracts, we'll talk about unconscious contracts in just a moment, the more that we see others in the same light, we'll see others' generosity, we'll see others as being blocked by their own unconscious contracts rather than seeing others as being deliberately wanting to cause harm to us or to others. There are also qualities and desires that we don't want to admit that we have that we may project upon others. For example, unacceptable sexual desires, which we'll often see in homophobia when someone is very anti-homosexual. Sometimes there's a sense that they have never gotten to really be supported in their own exploration of self, that they've never gotten to be their whole fluid gendered self, for example. Sexual orientation. The more support that people have, the less they have to put their unacceptable desires onto others. We'll often disown our own aggression, our own contempt, our own depression, our own anxiety, our own lack of attentional stability, our own addictions, our own compulsions. We can discover what we're disowning by asking ourselves, what type of person are we most irritated by at the present time? So if I'm most irritated by false positivity at the present time, then what is the way in which I am being driven into false positivity by my own unconscious contracts, for example? Carl Jung writes, "The best political, social, and spiritual work that we can do is to withdraw the projection of our own shadow from what we've put onto others." And the places where the shadow tends to sneak through and be projected on others without our knowing it are those moments when we lose real consciousness that others exist, and it'll sneak through in humor, it'll sneak through in bullying, it'll sneak through in generalizations about other people, it will sneak through when we're trying to get things done, when we're attracted to someone or something, or when we want something, when we're engaged in another task, when we're disappointed or heartbroken, when we're angry or frightened, when we're hungry or tired or panicked. This happened to me just recently. I was driving and it was a windy road and most of my attention was going to driving. But I was trying to have a conversation at the same time and I said something quite judgmental about people that were not using their votes to stop Trump. So it was a particular, you know, I had a particular idea of a particular strategy in mind. And it was an expression which did not truly take the other person into account. It was an expression that snuck through. It's like there's a pain in me that snuck through and did not acknowledge the other person where they were. It was just like a snap judgment and condemnation rather than an openness and a capacity to see and a capacity to really be with what other people believe and the other ways that people are seeing the world that we live in, which is so valuable for us to have more than one way to see the world that we live in. So here's a bit of our healing journey of the shadow, and this is a bit of the healing journey that we'll be on in the class that we're working with, which doesn't have the title shadow in it. It's just about relationships and places where we get caught in relationships, but definitely the places that we get caught in relationships are shadow places. So here's a bit about our healing journey. We say, okay, I have an unconscious that affects me all the time and tends to pull me away from relationality. We're able to say that there's a gravitational pull that takes us away from relationality. And then the next piece is, oh, okay, I can learn about this. I can learn about microaggressions. I can learn about the way in which I'm my power tends to have a gravitational pull that takes me away from generosity and empathy. We can start to do time travel rescues, repairs, and post-hearsals when we notice that we have gone in directions we don't enjoy or have taken action or spoken in ways that are outside of our integrity. and we can learn about unconscious contracts and their release. And so here we are, coming towards the end of our hour here, and we're going to spend a little bit of time thinking about unconscious contracts that can have an impact on us and our shadow selves. So if we take this experience, for example, that I was in, where that I find myself in fairly often when I'm trying to deal with current political climate in the United States, where I find myself very judgmental, and it just sneaks through in many ways, explicitly and implicitly, with folks who I'm around who also are involved in our current day life, our contemporary life, but maybe not the same way that I am. So what is my unconscious contract here that stops me from being able to be in real deep and true relational connection? What is the deep need that I'm meeting with my unconsciousness? I, Sarah, so here I can try this out. What is my unconscious contract? How have I contracted with myself to stay in the unconscious state? I, Sarah, solemnly swear to my essential self that I will not fully become conscious of my own contempt, rage, fury, outrage, sense of injustice, longing for, so as I just touch into this longing, I'm just imagining the first person who is in the White House right now. I'm imagining how much my whole being recoils. Like, I don't want to believe. I will remain unconscious of my own condemnation, and I will remain unconscious of my own pain, really. I will remain unconscious of my own pain about the current political situation in order to keep from my brain melting, with the rage and the, I will experience incomprehension and denial, not denial exactly, it's more denial of my own unconsciousness in order to, and here's where the need comes in. What is the deep need that I'm meeting? I'm preserving my own life because I don't believe that I could be present in my own body with that amount of rage and horror. It's like if I keep it at bay, then I will survive because I won't be putting my finger into the electrical socket. So it's a contract for unconsciousness in favor of survival. I, Sarah, solemnly swear. And then that takes us, see, a level deeper. Now that we've started to touch it, I can say, okay, here, and this is, of course, the beauty of our pattern-making brains. Our pattern-making brains will also help us see the ways in which we have patterns of implicit bias and patterns of unconscious visiting of our projections onto others and onto the world. So now the next level that I see is I, Sarah, solemnly swear to my essential self that I will not fully inhabit my own pain. I will not fully inhabit my own outrage, despair, horror, shame, and shock. I will not fully inhabit it in order to survive and to keep from putting my own finger in my own light socket and electrocuting myself to kingdom come, no matter the cost to myself. I will remain unconscious in order to survive. I will remain unconscious of my own pain in order to survive. And so as I say, in order to survive, now it's time to bring forward the living energy of needs, which is beautiful work, which we learned from Susan Skye and also from Robert Gonzalez, just really honoring my teacher Susan Skye in this and touching into the way that it feels, touching into both survival, but also with the help of this work, I'm now inviting myself to touch into what it's like to have this level of pain. What it's like to have this level of pain for folks who are at the border, folks who are immigrating out of really dangerous situations, being stuck in strange, children being imprisoned in the prison camps, just like letting myself actually exist with the reality of that existing. How is it for my body if I do not diminish my own unconsciousness? If I do not diminish my own pain with my own unconsciousness. And as I invite myself to step into this supported place, and this is why this slide is here with us, this slide showing the words love, the word love, the letters for love, then I can say that I feel, almost like I can feel this, the roots of the rage running through my torso down into my gut and sourcing themselves in a tremendous love. And the tremendous love is really the most important thing. And this, I think, is what we are all in a way in reaction against, is allowing ourselves to really feel the power and the significance of our own love. And once we begin to be able to bear our own capacity for love, then we're able to live in new ways that we discover as we go. New ways of self-connection, new ways of integrated self-care, new decisions for self and the world. That there's something quite extraordinary about our little human being bodies that have this enormous capacity that is almost never seen or reflected, that is almost never fully known. And as we're coming just to our last minute here, I just want to invite you to feel past your own dismay, horror, worry, sense of disconnection, shock, and to really allow yourself to sink into yourself as a being who is, in essence, a deep and personal lover of what is, a love of the world, a love of the non-human animals, a love of the human animals, a love of nature, a love of the planet. And to feel this. This is where we're headed. This is what we're working on. What happens with ourselves when we allow ourselves to be informed by NVC and relational neuroscience or interpersonal neurobiology. When we begin to see that all brains make patterns, no brains have an innate tendency to see their own privilege. We all believe that everyone's world is just like ours. All brains hold implicit biases. All brains hold default mode networks that classify self and other based on external signs and internal patterns and can have trauma vortices. We are human in these explorations. The more conscious we become, the more choice we have. The more conscious we become, the more we can mitigate the unconscious harm that comes from our shadows. Jung's experience was of a descent into and through a deep depression in his healing that took him through the hero's journey. And he writes, "The shadow is a tight passage, a narrow door whose painful constriction no one is spared who goes down to the deep well." And here is a little graphic of the hero's journey and our return with our gifts as we come out of the relationship with the shadow into a sense of greater wholeness. We become our own wounded healers for self and others. Tonight we won't be doing questions and answers since I'm not live with you, but if you come to the class, it starts in January, we will be able to do lots of process work, lots of questions and answers. Thank you so much. Sending you love. Good evening or goodbye.